History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And the reality is, they don't have to go untold. If we'll just take the initiative to ask a few questions of some of our neighbors who have lived a little longer than we have. And perhaps what's more important is that we patiently listen to what some of the answers to those questions might be. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out ahead because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The story we're going to hear today in San Diego, California, is a story of great heartbreak, a story of loss, but also a story of perseverance, of hope, and of always finding a way to put others before yourself. That's what Betty Rosevere has been doing for nearly a century. Betty was one of the more than 300,000 women who served in U.S. Armed Forces during World War II. She did so in the Army Nurse Corps, but before that, she experienced something that none of us would ever choose to experience. She became a Gold Star widow. Her husband, Billy Huffman, was one of the more than 406,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II. We're going to learn a little bit about him and a lot about Betty over the next hour. I just wanted you to have that little overview, but we'll start with the first impression most people have when they meet Betty. We've all heard it said that it's not polite to ask a woman her age, but the answer Betty gives to that question doesn't seem to fit with the active lifestyle she maintains in San Diego, where she serves as companion and caregiver for a World War II Navy veteran named Vic Walters, from whom we'll hear in a future episode. It really doesn't quite seem possible that Betty Rosevere was born in June of 1921. 99 years old?
Right.
Is that the truth?
Yep.
How often do you get asked that, Betty?
I don't tell anybody anymore because they think I'm something's wrong with me.
They don't believe you.
They think I have good eyesight and I'm doing about everything myself and they don't believe me.
What do they say at the DMV?
Well, I still have a driver's license because if you can see well and you can pass all of the stuff with the, and I use a computer, I still do that. And so I answered all the questions correctly, and my daughter was there waiting for me, you know, and I said, well, I passed. I think I can drive until 2024, I think.
So that's the year you'll turn 103.
My kids won't let me drive much anymore.
Well, let's just ask this question now. I won't build the suspense for the whole time. What's your secret to having such good eyesight, to being so mentally sharp and in such great shape at 99 and a half years old?
I think my parents helped. I think my parents were great. All those children, and yet we had a wonderful life. I really did.
And you say all those children.
Ten. Yep. Ten children, yes.
And where do you fit into that?
I think I'm about the seventh.
The seventh of ten. Mm-hmm. Born north of the border in Alberta.
Yes.
On a cattle farm?
Yes.
And how old were you when you moved to the States?
I was probably about three. I'm not sure. I don't remember anything about it. My grandfather came from Nebraska, and he had a big touring car. So we got all in that. They had some boards on the side, and he drove us down from Canada, and he left that car with my dad. My dad said it was so big that he could never get rid of it. And then they wanted to tax him here for it, so he drove it back to Canada and sold it there.
So tell us where you grew up.
In the state of Washington, just a little north of Portland, Oregon. And I went to nurses training in Oregon, Baker, Oregon. And so, I was there several years. That's where I met my first husband. He was in college then, and I was a student nurse. And I met him at a dance.
Well, I want to hear about that. When you're the seventh of ten children, that has to be an entertaining existence.
Yes.
I imagine that means all the kids have to do something to contribute to the family, to the farm, to the household. What do you remember about that childhood in the 1920s? What were some of the things that you had to do?
I churned the butter every Saturday. It was a big wooden thing that you put the, my mother put all the milk in it, and or probably she saved the some of the heavy milk for it. And then I would, I was the only one had the patience to sit there and pump it up and down. But actually, we didn't have many tasks on the farm, really. My dad worked in town. My mother was very efficient, but everything was pretty well organized. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have to do too much. But we rode the bus to school because we lived out of the city town about 8 miles. But we had a wonderful life on the farm. We used to go walk around, take people up. We had a lot of relatives that came to visit from different, from Nebraska and different places. And we would take them up in the hills. And we had a little stream that ran through the farm. And we used to go down and take something out of the garden. My dad had a nice, great big vegetable garden. And we could stick carrots or something in the water and wash them off and eat them.
So how'd you get along with those 9 siblings?
Well, actually, we really did pretty well. But I had, most of mine were sisters, so my brothers were all older. So that was like a big separation. But my sisters were pals. Like we used to go for walks together and do things together, you know. And they were really good at. I got a bicycle. We never got many presents for Christmas, except underwear and stockings. Then when I was about 13, my dad wheeled out of the bedroom a girl's bicycle.
Ooh.
So my younger sister, or some of my sisters and I, were always out on the bicycle going up and down this gravel road, pumping away.
Taking turns.
Yeah, taking turns, yeah.
I have 2 teenage daughters, and they love each other. But if it's up to whose turn is it, sometimes there's a disagreement about whose turn it is. So when you have 7 girls taking turns on one bicycle...
No, they didn't. My older ones didn't bother. It was the younger ones.
So it was only 3 or 4 girls taking turns on one bicycle?
Yeah.
Yet you all lived to tell the story.
Yeah.
And I imagine life was different for a young girl then than it is in 2021.
Oh, boy, yes. Yeah. Well, in some ways it wasn't. You know, we used to do each other's hair and things like that. But I never had long hair because my mother was great at cutting hair. If you have all those girls, you don't have long hair.
She had to manage it, huh?
Yeah, right.
I have to ask, because the people that lived through this time, everyone experienced it differently, and some have vivid memories, some don't. But those depression years, did you see that weigh on your parents? Did you see your family dealing with that economic hardship in a way that helped you get through it?
I don't think as we did as much as other people. Somehow or other, my mother and father were very good at taking care of things. My mother would even save money. We always felt fairly good about how things were at that time. When we talk about it, when I talk about it with my sisters, I only have one left now. But we always talked about the good things, you know, that happened that were really good. We were really lucky that we didn't have all of the problems that other people had.
Mm-hmm.
People who didn't have the land. My dad had 45 acres, so that meant you had all firewood you needed, you know, things like that.
And I bring up the difference between young ladies now and then, because today, if you're a girl going to school, there's nothing that's off the table, right? There's any kind of job, any kind of career that is an option for you. When you were a young lady, that wasn't necessarily the case. Did you have an idea growing up of, here's something that I am going to be able to do with my life, that I want to do with my life?
No, I think it was harder then,
you know,
to get some kind of job. I was lucky. One of my sisters lived in Eastern Oregon, and she wanted me to come and visit her. So I went there, and she said to me, why don't you go to the hospital here? They're taking in student nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 2 weeks, I was a student nurse after I finished high school. So somehow or other, I don't know. I think I had it easier than some people did. But I had a lot of friends that had a hard time, and families that one of my best friends, her father died and her mother had the 2 children. Her brother stayed with cousins because they had no place to live. And then she became a student nurse like I did. We were in high school together, you know, so we thought we were lucky because a lot of people weren't able to do that. I don't know. It turned out really well for me because I liked it.
Well, but you would deal with some hardships as well that we're going to hear about. What was it about nursing
that was a draw for you? What appealed to you about that career?
Well, I always liked doing things for people. I take care of Vic, you know.
Yeah.
And I took care of my husband when he was at a bad heart, was ill for several few years. And I always kind of liked doing that, so it was easy for me.
So this is all before World War II still, at least before America's in the war.
Right.
So you go to nursing school there in Baker City, you said, Eastern
yes,
Oregon.
Right.
Become a nurse. When did you meet Billy?
Well, he was in college at the State College. His father lived on a farm. His mother died when he was born, and he had a very, very nice stepmother, and he was the only child, though, which was a terrible tragedy for him, for his father. I went to a dance with some of the nurses would go to this place where they used to have the bands that came and played in a hall someplace.
Sure.
We went off there, and I met him there.
And was this before Pearl Harbor still?
Yes. Oh, yes. He was still in college then. About the last year as a student nurse, I went to take my boards in Oregon, and I worked at a children's hospital when they had a polio pandemic. It was really bad. Then he went to Texas for training to be a pilot. So then he called me up. I'd known him then probably off and on about 2 years because he went back to school, and then I was still in Baker, Oregon. I finished there. Then I was in Portland when he called me and asked me if I would marry him, and I said yes.
So he proposed over the phone?
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, we kind of knew that anyhow by that time, yeah. But he was kind of shy, and so was I. Maybe it was easier for him on the phone, you know?
Maybe.
And people were different in those days, you know. He came to Portland, and we got married in Portland, Oregon. And then we were together off and on for a while. And then he moved to a field in Walla Walla, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were together there for a while, for about a few weeks. And then eventually he went to South Dakota, Rapid City, I think it's called. And I went there, flew there to see him, and then he went to England. So that was the last time I saw him.
You met him. He's a college student. He becomes a pilot. You guys are married. But then America's at war.
Yes.
And he's being sent overseas.
Yes. Well, one thing about him was that his mother died when he was born, maybe 2 weeks after he was born. And she called him Billy Lou. Mm-hmm. And when, after the war, you know, after all this happened, I got in touch with the 452nd group. First thing they asked me was he from the South?
Because of Billy Lou?
He didn't look like a Billy Lou. So they said, well, then he named his airplane Mavourin, and that's a song that I used to sing to him. He loved that song. I don't know, it's not really anything special, but it's what the nuns used to sing together.
Mm.
So they taught it to me because I kind of liked it. It's Come Back to Erin, Mavourin, Mavourin. I can't sing anymore. Come back, Aroon, for the land of your birth. And so he loved that song. That's the first thing, those two things they asked me. Was he from the South? And why did he name his ship Mavourin?
And that's why.
Yeah, and my daughter then, by that time, I didn't talk to him about him for years. And my daughter said to me, could we find out some more about him? And so I said, okay. So she's the one who went on the computer and found all kinds of stuff. And then they sent me every month I can't see that.
The Bomb Group newsletter?
Yeah, they had a group, you know, that they
yeah.
got together. And they wanted me to come, but I don't remember someplace else. And I was always busy.
Mm.
I lived in a lot of different countries, as you can see by all the things.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sad thing, I think the hardest part for me was his father. First he lost his wife, and then Billy was only about 22 or 3 or something like that. And then he loses his only son.
Yeah.
And he didn't last very long after that. He died. What we talk about a broken heart, he had that, you know. And
it
was really terrible. Yeah. It was terrible for me, but I think his father was the one I sympathized with the most. It was just as if he took his whole life away.
And I know, even though it's been this long, this is something that can still trigger a lot of powerful emotions, and I want to be sensitive to that.
Yeah.
But what can you tell me about Billy? What kind of guy was he? What was it that made you love him the way you did?
Well, he was just very kind and sort of shy. He loved taking pictures, took so many pictures of me. He was very good at doing a lot of things. He loved being with people. He was always happy, but he wasn't very talkative. He was, when we used to go out for dinner with somebody when we were in Walla Walla, we just had a room in a house, so we always went out with several people from his group. And we always had such a good time. He was just a really nice, quiet, sweet person. Yeah. I'm lucky, you know, that my second husband was like that, too.
So you met some of his crew before they shipped out?
Yes, I did, but I don't remember. I remember one because there's a guy who comes on TV, looks just like him, with the same last name, Mattingly. And I keep wondering, I wonder if he is a relative of Howard Mattingly. He was a navigator on another plane, and they were good friends. So we got together, and he was married, too. And he had a really nice young wife, and we always had such good times together. This was in Walla Walla, Washington. His plane disappeared. I heard later on, I read some things about different planes that they had found. They found some of the people on his plane. It went down in someplace in Europe in the water, and they never found him. But I used to write to his wife. She remarried like I did. She had four children. I had three, and we used to go back and forth about it.
Yeah,
it was a bad time. We had wonderful times together, though. It wasn't too upsetting until until he left, and that then I knew then. When I went to South Dakota, I knew that was the last time I would see him. I only saw him for the weekend, and then he was gone again.
Are you suggesting that you had a premonition or an inkling that something would happen to him?
No, I didn't. I wrote to him every single day. I wrote to him, and he wrote to me as much as he could. No, I never. He was always so self-assured, you know. He was a good pilot. He was very friendly, but it was probably too good at what he did. He was in the front of the Big Week. Do you remember?
Leading the formation?
Yeah. Did you ever read anything about Big Week, the 2 weeks when they were, that was February 20th and on, the 2 weeks then, when they put up all those planes?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was one of the leading planes.
The B-17, flown by Betty's husband, Billy Lou Huffman, had taken off from Depham Green, home to the 452nd Bomb Group in England. The target was in Poland, but that required flying across Germany. The bomber was attacked by German fighter planes, and rockets from those Junkers Ju-88s struck the American aircraft, which would eventually come down near Korsør, Denmark. You can find photos and related information at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And when we come back, we'll hear from Betty about what happened, about how she found out, and the decision she made to join the armed forces herself after her husband had been killed in action. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with soon-to-be 100-year-old Betty Rosevere of San Diego, California. Born in Alberta, Canada, she grew up on a farm near Kelso, Washington, the seventh of 10 children. She explained to us how, while going to nursing school in Eastern Oregon, she met a young man from Vail, Oregon, by the name of Billy Lou Huffman. I know we've got quite a few listeners around Salem, Oregon, where Hometown Heroes has aired every weekend for years on KYKN, 1430 on the AM dial. If that's the area where you're listening today, you could venture over to the Salem Pioneer Cemetery and find Billy's grave. He was just 23 years old when he became one of the more than 406,000 Gold Star heroes of World War II, giving his life in the service of our country. Up until that fateful day, the B-17 pilot had been exchanging letters with his bride, who told us she wrote a new letter every single day after he deployed with the 452nd Bomb Group.
We just talked about each other and what I was doing, what we would do when he came back and things like that, you know. And I went down to see his father and stepmother. He had a very nice stepmother, and she was always very helpful to her father because he had a really bad time with the whole thing. It was just too hard to believe that it was all so quickly, you know. We were married on the day before my birthday, June 3rd, and I think he was gone the next year. It wasn't very long. We were together in Walla Walla. It all went so fast. Sometimes I forget the dates because it seemed like we were just constantly moving or doing something.
Maybe you can do this for me as much as you're comfortable with. Can you tell me what you understand about what happened to him and then also how you found out?
Well, when my daughter found out, right away we were contacted by a man that lived where his plane went down, the island in Denmark. And actually, my family, my husband, second husband, and my whole family, we had been on that island, and I had no idea that he had been buried there. But his father had him brought home. But this man, Sven Buch is his name, he sent us all kinds of it. He sent a picture of the people at the cemetery where he had been where he was buried. And then he sent us a picture of the plane lying in the field. And my husband was found by that plane. And then I got something from the government, but he had like a museum of all the people that had crashed on his island. And I got something from him about a month ago, too. He still does something like that. This work for he does for all of these things that people were there on this island. So I think there were three or four other B-17s that crashed on that island, plus other people from there. What they tried to do was to get to Sweden. So my husband was in Germany in the plane, and they were shot down, and somehow they got to Denmark. But by that time, they'd had some bad damage to the plane, and only two people survived. And I never did get to meet those two people, two sergeants, I think they were. They think that some of them went in the water and never were found for a long time. One time later on, they thought they found some equipment from one of them. And then there was one man that went to the hospital and died in the hospital. And then there was another man on the plane who the Danish fishermen were trying to go out to get him and take him out of the water because it was so cold. It was February. And they were stopped by the Germans. And the Germans took him out of the water and threw him on the deck of the boat and brought him into the harbor. So they didn't try to revive him or anything. Then my husband died near the plane. I think his parachute didn't open. He was the last one off the plane.
The pilot's the last one out.
Yeah, and there were two men then left, only two, that survived it all and were the POWs. So sometimes I get this whole vision in my head of that island that we visited, that we'd be by train across to this island, and I didn't know that that's where he had been buried even at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, all came out later.
So his plane shot down, he's killed, they bury him there, but then the family says we'd like to have him back in the States, and they bring him back. But for you, how did you find out what had happened to your husband?
Well, I had gone to Seattle with another sister who asked me to come, and I had a room in the house they were living in. And then I worked at a children's hospital in Seattle, and I got a letter from the government that he was killed in action. They knew that right away. So then my old friend from high school, another nurse, asked me if I would come down and stay with her and her mother. I thought I would like to be with some other friends, you know, and I was alone there with my sister, and I hardly knew anybody in Seattle, but I knew people in Portland. So I told my friend I'll come. Then somebody came to the house after I left, but I didn't see them. I think they sent two men, two army people there, but I never saw them. So I went to Portland, and then that's when she talked me into going in the army.
Well, I want to hear about that, but but first I think it's important that the rest of us try to understand what that must be like. Because there were 400,000 Americans who died in the war. There have been over 1 million Americans who died in the various wars over all these years. And most of us never know what it's like to be the Gold Star widow or the Gold Star mother, the Gold Star sibling. I'm sure you had had great plans that you and Billy talked about the life you would have together, the family you would have, and all that. What was it like for you to receive that news, and how did you deal with it?
Well, I didn't deal with it very well. I think I just kind of, I never went out much. I stayed with my friend and her mother. Her mother had had her husband die when they were small children. And so it wasn't that she wanted to talk about it or anything like that. She didn't. She was just kind of there all the time and helpful without being talking about it or, you know, interfering in any way. So it was a good place to be because she'd already done that with her husband when the two, my friend and her brother, were very small. Her husband had died. Just he became ill and died, that was all. So then I decided I should go to work. Well, I went to work one night finally. I had a special one patient and I was taking care of him. I could hardly think at all. So I came out and sat down. And the nurse said to me, "What happened?" She looked at my face and she put her arms around me and said, "What happened?" So then I told her, and she said to me, "You need to go home and stay for a while. Don't go to work." Because I just couldn't think, you know.
Sure, the grief was so strong.
Yeah. So I went, when I went back with my friend Eleanor and her mother said to me, "Betty, just stay here. We'll just do some things together and talk. Don't try to think about working it." So I did that for about 2 weeks. Then I worked again a little bit here and there. But that was the worst time, I think. But I know she sympathized with me, but she was left with two children, you know. I thought later, well, it's in a way, it's probably good I didn't have. That was Billy's idea. He said, no, no children.
You guys talked about it.
Yes, we talked,
because of
yes.
the risk that he knew he was encountering.
Yeah.
Wow.
He said, "I'll be back, but that's when we'll be together," you know, so... But a lot of people, friends we knew of, that we met from his group, some of the women were pregnant, you know. Certainly Janet, my best friend, with her husband, they never found his body even again, you know. So she said the best thing was that we didn't have children that have to go worry about that, think about that.
And I just thought of something else you said. You mentioned that he loved to take pictures of you.
Oh, boy. I'll show them to you when we're finished.
And I understand you still have the camera he took those photos with.
Uh-huh.
Do you think he had a picture of you in the cockpit with him?
I had a little gold frame, and he had it hanging there all the time. Yeah, I got it back. They gave it back to me. They said it was his. It came back with his clothes. His stepmother, they had the clothes because I had no place permanent, you know. Then the picture was there. She gave it to me, of me in a little gold frame. Yeah, he loved to take pictures. He had a beautiful big camera. I think he spent all his money on his camera one time when he worked for a while for a man who did aerial photography, and so that's how he bought his camera.
So here you are. You're a nurse. You're a newlywed. You find out your husband has been killed in the war, courageously staying with the plane so some of his crew could survive. Two of them survived because of his sacrifice. And you decided to do something else. In the midst of all that grief, you decided to serve our country as an army nurse.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I couldn't seem to... I was just lost, sort of, you know. And I had two friends. I went to Fort Lewis in Washington. I met these two people that I kind of got really friendly with. One of them was Alfield Peterson. I think her father was a fisherman. She had gone to college, became a nurse. I called her Pete all the time because her last name was Peterson. And she was a foot taller than I think. And she was a great fell. Blonde hair. She was really bright. She's really great. And then the other friend with her was my friend Florence Graham, who was a Lakota Sioux. And so the three of us stuck it out and joined the Army and went on the same ship to the Philippines. We were 31 days on a ship. By the time we got off the ship, we were friends for life. We were, until they died.
Oh, I believe it.
Yeah.
Was there any part of you that considered that you might be setting yourself up for more heartache with some of the things you'd be seeing or doing over there?
Well, I was lucky in that. All the men I took care of had PTSD. We were trying to get them home. And I was in a hospital on Leyte eventually. I was with some in Manila. Then they sent me to Leyte. And I was in a tent hospital in Leyte. And everybody in the tent hospital had the same. They didn't talk much. They just sat. And some of them didn't even talk to each other, hardly. It was really, really bad.
These are all soldiers, Marines, sailors who had been through battle and were traumatized.
Yes, badly.
Carrying some heavy emotional, mental scars.
What we did, we took care of them until they could get them home.
What would you do for them?
Not very much. We talked to them and watched them. Because we had one who tried to commit suicide, and from that, well, we always had people who watched because we weren't sure. They weren't sure what they would do because they were. Some of them were just unbelievably distraught, and some of them just stared and sat. And I think we'd lost them for a while. You know, some of them were really mentally ill by that time.
That couldn't have been easy for you to see people in that state.
Well, as a nurse, you get different things. First, I had children that were terribly sick, and we had the polio epidemic and things like that. You know, it's just that you just think, well, they're just sick, and they were sick as everybody else. I don't think any of them had many wounds. They were just gone, you know? And so you just take care of them the best you can. That's it. Yeah. It wasn't easy.
How long were you over there?
Well, I wasn't even in the Army very long, you know. Just under 2 years, I think. I didn't go in. My husband died in 1944. And then I went in the Army. And then I was out, in no time at all.
But if she hadn't made that decision to join the Army Nurse Corps after her first husband was killed in action, Betty never would have met her second husband. When I asked her what she's most proud of, she didn't hesitate in answering her three children. And those three children wouldn't be here without the military assignment that allowed Betty to make that connection with their father. We'll hear about it when we come back. If you'd like to see photos of Betty then and now, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the moving life story we've been listening to today from 99-year-old Betty Rosevere of San Diego, California. She was only 22 when she received the news that her bomber pilot husband, Billy Lou Huffman, had been killed in action. The B-17 he had been piloting shot down by German fighters. He stayed with the plane long enough for every member of his crew to bail out, sacrificing his own life in the process. Two men were able to survive because of his courage, but a young widow was left trying to envision a new future. I wonder how many of us would have made the same choice she made to join the Army Nurse Corps and go overseas to the Philippines. We're going to come back around to some of those experiences with Betty in a bit, but after Japan surrendered and you returned home from the Pacific, tell me where it was you ended up and why that would prove so important for the rest of your life.
We came back, and then I was at the Presidio in San Francisco, and that's where my second husband had his master's degree then, and he did a lot of work in psychology. Mm-hmm. And so he was on the same area where I was, where people, again, I had people that had problems getting back into, you know, trying to live a normal life when things had been so terrible for some of them.
These are veterans who are trying to assimilate to civilian life.
This was, at the Presidio, San Francisco. That's where I met him. And so for about a year or two, we used to go out with different people. And so then we kind of had a group, and I was with him and this group. He was a really, really nice man. I was so lucky. Really great. He's the father of my children. Bill Rosevere from England. We served in the American Army. He always thought he'd be going back to England, but he never did. He always got some job like I did, where you take care of people. Yeah. Then he got his own. We had a good life. He got his PhD, and I have wonderful children. Great. I'm lucky.
You know, I've had so many Marines over the years say, once a Marine, always a Marine. Listening to you, I kind of get this idea, once a nurse, always a nurse.
I think so, yeah.
You're still doing it.
Well, yes. My husband, after he got his doctorate, he got some kind of a thing with University of Southern California. So they asked him to go to different countries. So I didn't realize that at first. So the first country we went to live in was Pakistan.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we went to live in Brazil. Then we moved, we lived in India, and then the last country we lived in was Germany. So this took a period of time. It was about 2 years or more for each country, and then we'd move in between, and then finally we came back here to this house. So during that time, we saw a lot of different countries and different people. I did volunteer nursing in Pakistan.
Wow.
And I did volunteer nursing in India. Germany, they take care of their people. They have a gigantic national health program, unbelievably good. And in Brazil's more of a place where it has the very poor and huge areas, you know. Mm-hmm. They lived up on the hills. You know why they lived on the hills? No water. They had to carry water up. They all lived up in the favelas, and then down by the embassy were the wealthy people. Mm. And so when they used to laugh, because when it rained, all the trash from up above came down.
Just out of curiosity, whose cuisine did you like the most out of all those countries?
Oh, I like them all. I make Indian food.
I love Indian food.
I do too. And then in Brazil, we still make feijoada, the beans.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah. And my girls like it. So we all do this together, you know. Mm-hmm. They love it too.
Well, hearing about that, hearing the richness of the life that you lived, the places you got to see, you know, this big adventure that was out there that you couldn't have known when you were a war widow signing up to go be a nurse in the Philippines. What was it at that time, such a time of crisis and tragedy and loss, what was it that gave you hope that there was something still to live for that led to this incredible life the last 75 years?
I don't think I really thought of it that way. It was just that I could always find something to do that I liked. I don't think I really worried about it very much. I always had something else I could do. Even when I lived in other countries, I did a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But also in some countries like India, there's a million things to see. You could go to the Kashmir. We stayed on a houseboat in the Kashmir. My daughter Anne came, and my son was with us then. My other daughter wasn't there, but we always have done things together, all of us. So I think you just have so many things. I've always been very busy doing things. I even worked here for when my husband was doing his doctorate. Then I worked in a hospital for the mentally ill. Maybe because it never bothered me, you know. And I think a lot of people were just people that life just got, they just got overrun with life. And I never did that. I was always thought that things were always pretty good most of the time for me. You just wait until things get better. Maybe that's it. And then in the meantime, I can do something to keep busy.
The 2 years as an Army nurse, the time you spent overseas in the Philippines. What was the most challenging or eye-opening aspect of that?
Well, I think I saw so many people. Now we call it PTSD, but in those days, people didn't know what to do with it. It was really a problem, you know. So you just tried to be, you know, friendly and helpful, and but it was really a terrible time. And I often wondered, where did those thousands of people that I saw, where did they go? What happened to them? That's the worst part.
Not knowing what the rest of their lives looked like.
Yeah. One of the things I always thought about that time was that people were so kind to me. Because every place you go, you have papers that tell you're a widow. And I can't tell you how nice and great people were to me. You know, helpful and everything.
They had compassion.
Yeah.
Which clearly you have.
Well, it seems to me that was a better time than we have now, you know, with the pandemic and a lot of things in the government, and you feel we're not, you know, it's just not right to treat people badly. And, you know, we were just overwhelming sometimes about what were they going to do. And then you'd think, well, you do this and you do this and things will be all right. You know, we'll work through it somehow. But now it seems like people are really, with the pandemic as well, it's an awful, awful time.
I think I hear you saying that there was a different spirit in America then compared to now.
So. I think so. I really do. Yeah. Or was it, I don't know, part of my life? People were so good to me, you know. But it was not just that. We had so many things we wanted to do for other people. Well, and that's why I take care of Vic.
Mm-hmm. So you would have been in the Philippines when the war in Europe ended, when Germany surrendered to the Allies.
Yes, yes.
Was there any significance to that for you, given what your husband had done and sacrificed for? And you sacrificed your husband, if we want to look at it that way.
Well, I don't think you look at it that way. It's just, even though my children never knew my husband, my first husband, they were like my second husband, who was very kind and gentle. And so they said to me, they want to know about him. My daughters, two daughters did. They want to know where he was buried. And I said, well, his father brought him back, and he's in Salem. So then they wanted to go there and see where he was buried. There, you know, I mean, we all kind of go together with it was, and I told them all about him, and then they thought they were lucky. They had a really good father, you know. He was great. And he never, you know, it's always like it was just another life that you had to do, live a new family.
What about for you when the war in the Pacific ended? Because you're out there in the Pacific, and now Japan has surrendered. Was that a memorable occasion?
Oh, yes. Oh, people, we just couldn't believe it, you know. It was unbelievable. So then we got rid of a lot of people. Suddenly things started to move more. First of all, you had trouble because they were afraid to send ships. Sometimes the ships, you couldn't go out. They were afraid they'd get lose more ships or more planes or whatever.
That submarines or kamikazes would get them?
Yeah. So then everything opened up and things moved along. I flew home. I couldn't find my, I couldn't even find my two nurse friends. But then when we got home, we got together again. But then I went overseas, see, after that. When I remarried, I was gone. We never lost track of each other, though, because they were the ones that went through a lot with me.
Sounds like a big part of your life, that friendship.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep you forever. I just have a couple more questions, and if I leave anything out, feel free to fill it in. You got to go to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight San Diego.
Right.
Visit the World War II Memorial.
Yeah.
Where there's all those gold stars representing 406,000 Americans.
No, I didn't like that. Well, first we went to the Vietnam one.
Mm.
And there are people touching the names and walking along and in groups and hugging each other and crying. I thought the one with the stars was, I don't know. We didn't even know what it was at first. And then somebody came along and I said, well, what's this for? And they told us. It was sort of a disappointment to see just for what's 400 people in a star?
100 people for every star, and there's 4,000 stars.
Yeah.
So I think what I hear you saying is that the names at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall made that a more powerful experience.
Oh, you should see people standing. Did you go there?
Oh, sure, yeah.
You remember when we were there? There were people all lined up all along, touching the names and things. At that time, see, there were still a lot of vets that when we went.
You wished you could have seen your late husband's name somewhere at the World War II Memorial. Instead, it's because the number was so much greater than Vietnam, eight times as many people died, that they don't have all the names.
No.
Did that experience, going there, taking your daughter there, did that give you some perspective on why what you did, what your late husband, what so many others did, was so important?
Yes. Yeah, because I was a part of it, too, you know. So it was a great thing, I thought, to have that. The Korean one was rather interesting, different, too.
That's haunting.
Yeah.
Did they take you to the Women's Memorial at Arlington?
Oh, yes, yes. See, my name is there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is there anything else about the war years that I didn't ask you about that you think is important and maybe is important for us to think about, reflect on, or remember all these years later?
Well, some of the worst things I saw were at the Presidio. See, a lot of people were brought back that had really bad injuries, and there's where a lot of them went. Eisenhower came. I took some pictures of Eisenhower. He gave me a nice big smile, but I was too shy to go ask him if I could have a picture taken. I wanted to, but I didn't do it. But it was some of the things I saw were really bad. Yeah, really terrible.
The physical shape that some of these returning veterans were in.
Unbelievable things, yeah. But they tried, again, I think they were really kind to me because sometimes I got people that weren't as... I've been with nurses, and I had seen things that happened to some of them, but most of those, somebody else took care of them. The last one I had was a man who had, he was in bed, and he looked perfectly normal. When I went out, I said, well, he looks all right. And he said, well, you'll see later on, or something. We were busy talking about a little bit. We didn't really talk about patients very much. So I went back in, and I said to him, can you get out of bed, and I'll change your bed. And he said, oh, sure. So he got out of bed, and he had a tumor on his leg about like a watermelon.
Oh, wow.
And the sad thing was that he got this when it was smaller, and they told him the only way we can stop it at that time was to take off your leg, and he wouldn't let him do it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So then, so I took care of him for a while. Then he went home. They sent him home. To his family, because that was just the end for him. But I just couldn't believe it. He would look so, he's sitting in bed talking to me. He looked so normal, you know.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't have been there. Yeah, I knew something really terrible was happening. But until I really saw it, I couldn't even imagine it. So that was even worse maybe than getting someone wound or something. The other one, the guy was in a sling. They couldn't put him down. He had so many little bits of metal in his body. He was really bad. Yeah, some of them were just really horrific, you know. Yeah, some of them had terrible wounds, and
Well, here's what that makes me wonder, and I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head, but I'm wondering what perspective you might have. Because I'm thinking about, you know, at that National World War II Memorial, under those gold stars representing the 406,000 Americans who died in the war, including your husband, it says, here we mark the price of freedom. Sometimes if you go to a VA hospital, it'll say the price of freedom is visible here. And I think that some of the ways we think about this price of freedom is those who died, first of all, the ultimate sacrifice, those who are wounded, lost limbs, or you know, bad injuries, still carrying around metal, like you said. And then there's the one that's the hardest to see, which is that psychological or mental wound that you became so acquainted with in World War II. So really, you've seen firsthand every manifestation of that price of freedom. But what I wonder is what perspective that gives you about the value of freedom.
I think the worst thing I can imagine is the Vietnam War. I think if you can avoid it, you should do it. You wind up with people dead or sick or dying or mutilated. It's not for me. I just thought the Vietnam was just a terrible, terrible tragedy.
Let me ask you this. Has experiencing what you've experienced, you know, the perspective that you gained as a war widow, as a nurse, has it affected the way you live your life?
I don't get terribly upset by a lot of things. You know, part of what I see is just what happens to people. You know, you can't change that. So, but I think if you're attacked like we were at Pearl Harbor, that's a different story then, you know. Then we have to come together and fight back. You do.
If we didn't, the world would look very different now.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah.
You don't seem like someone who takes much for granted. You seem to have a purpose in what you do.
Well, I'm about finished with...
I don't know, Betty. You don't seem to be slowing down much. Have you started to think about your 100th birthday yet?
Yes, my kids... They said, when we can all get together, Mom, maybe July.
Even though your birthday's in June.
Yeah, we don't talk about June.
You have any advice for us younger folks who want to be thinking about their 100th birthday someday?
Just be good, be kind, and love people. Yeah, I tell Vic, I love you, Vic, you know, and he tells me that. Because I do. I love Vic. But each time I've had really, really people I loved. You can love more than one time, you know. Sometimes it's really hard to give it up, but you do. Okay.
Thank you, Betty.
Oh, thank you, Paul, for listening to me.
Thank you for sharing. Thank you for serving our country.
Oh, you're welcome.
That is Betty Rosevere, still serving others after nearly a century on this planet. We'll look forward to wishing her a very happy 100th birthday in June. And I don't know about you, but I would say the perspective that she's shared with us over the last hour is quite a gift. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com for photos and more information about Betty's story. And thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again of that truth that Betty's story underscored for us once again today. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.